What does it take to legally immigrate to America? How has it changed through the last century, and how do the rules differ from one country to the next? There's been a lot of heat around the issue of undocumented immigrants, but many of our ancestors came here and were allowed in with little more than a clean bill of health. How has that changed through the decades, and why? The process to legally get into the country today is our discussion on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Like a lot of Americans, when my grandparents came to America, my grandfather on one side got to the New York Harbor. He got a health inspection at Ellis Island before he could be approved to legally enter America. If you were not healthy, you could be put back on the ship that brought you to New York and sent back to where you came from. Of course, the immigration system today is a lot different. Here to talk about some of what immigrants face today is Anchorage immigration attorney Leah McDermid McKenna. Hi, Leah.
Hi.
Also, Vered Meres is an Anchorage business owner and very recently helped her husband become a legal citizen of our state. We'll learn more about that coming up. Hi, Vered.
Hello, Lori. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for being here. And also in the studio is Indra Arriaga. Indra is an artist based in Anchorage who came from Mexico many years ago as a child. Hi.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thanks, Indra, for being here. You can also join our conversation if you have an immigration question or a story of your journey to U.S. citizenship. Give us a call. Statewide, the number is 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. If you're in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So, Leah, let's start out with just some basics. What's the difference between a green card and full U.S. citizenship? What's that process?
So a green card is what someone who's a lawful permanent resident of the United States has. And someone who has a green card has all of the same rights and responsibilities as most of us living here in the United States. So you can work where you want. You can travel outside of the United States, but you'd be re-entering on the passport of your national origin, not a U.S. passport.
Really?
Yes.
So when does that ever change?
Well, if you naturalize and become a U.S. citizen, then, of course, you get a U.S. passport. And then at that point, you would have all the full rights that all U.S. citizens have who were born in the United States, including being able to vote in the United States, being able to travel on a U.S. passport, petitioning family members, and lots of other rights, federal jobs and that kind of thing.
So I have one of my grandparents' naturalization papers. What is that process to go from the green card to a naturalized citizenship?
So there's different ways, and it depends somewhat on the person's situation. But typically, after you've been a permanent resident for 3 years, if you got your green card through marriage, or 5 years, if you got your green card through any other way, you can apply for naturalization. There's certain requirements. You have to show that you can speak English and read and write and speak English, and that you can pass a civics exam, and that you've been a person of good moral character for either that 3 or 5 year period. So no serious crimes or really any crimes during that period.
Mm-hmm. So misdemeanors, anything.
During the 3 to 5 year period, you can't have really any convictions. But outside that period, it depends on the crime itself. And in very limited circumstances, you could possibly get away with applying with a very minor...
Like a parking ticket?
Yeah, parking tickets are fine. Traffic citations are fine.
Okay. I spoke to an attorney a while back talking a little bit about immigration, and this attorney said that there's kind of like four ways to immigrate, and I wanted to ask you if this makes sense. Immediate family members, students, employment, or seeking asylum. Is that kind of broke down in its most basic form?
Those are the main categories. Yeah, there's also the diversity visa lottery would be one other way that people obtain permanent residence. And then there's also when someone's in deportation or what's now called removal proceedings, there's something called cancellation of removal that an immigration judge can grant to a person and which ends up getting them permanent residence as well.
I want to talk a little about diversity visas in a bit, but I want to get to one more question and then move to Vered and also Indra to get them in this conversation. Leah, is it true that before the 1950s, you didn't really have to apply like my grandfather? If you were healthy, you just sort of got into the country?
I think there was still an application process, but it was definitely a lot simpler. There weren't the kind of backlogs that we see today. So currently, under the what's called the visa bulletin, there's a limit on the number of immigrant visa numbers that are issued every year. And so what you often see is that people, for example, a U.S. citizen petitioning a sibling is going to have to wait anywhere from 14 to 24 years to be able to immigrate to the United States. And then there's all different categories. There's spouses of U.S. citizens there who don't have any wait time. And then there's unmarried children, married children, and then whether they're under or over 21 will change the amount of time that they have to wait and what country they're from. Well, they may have to wait longer if they're from a country where there's a high number of people applying for immigrant visas in that category.
Did you say it can take more than two decades?
Yes.
In some cases?
Yes. Especially for those from the Philippines. The category for siblings, as well as adult children, can take more than two decades. And Mexico as well takes a very long time, 22 to 25 years in many cases.
That's extraordinary. This is Talk of Alaska, if you're just joining us. And today we're talking about the process for legal immigration. I have three guests in the studio with me today. Leah McDermid McKenna is an immigration attorney based in Anchorage. Vered Meres is a business owner in Anchorage and also just helped her husband recently come to Alaska and is now safely here. And Indra Arriaga is an artist and was born in Mexico and came to the country as a child. We'll learn more about that. Vered, let's hear from you now and the process that you went through getting your husband here. Where was he coming from and what did that take?
So I met my husband in Havana, Cuba back in 2015. And shortly after we decided to get married, I hired an immigration attorney, a Cuban-American woman named Amber Diaz, who's based out of Miami. And we started the process for the fiancé visa. That visa was actually rejected. They had decided, they meaning USCIS, had decided that my husband did not show intent to marry, which sort of baffled us given the 3 inches of evidence and planning that had gone into that binder. So instead, we decided to move the wedding to Havana, and we got married in Havana in 2016. And then we started the process for the spousal visa to bring him here, which, given that process, would allow him to come here as a permanent resident from the time he entered the country with all the privileges that could come, so he could start working right away when he got here. But we also had a hurricane that came through during the course of that in September when our original interview was scheduled, which shut down the embassy because it was inundated with water. And it was rescheduled to November. And then at the end of September, for diplomatic reasons, they effectively closed the embassy in Havana and then moved our interview to Bogota, Colombia, which meant we had to apply for a visa for him to travel to Colombia before we could even get to that immigration interview.
So another layer of bureaucracy.
And it's a very long process. I mean, you know, we started planning our wedding in early 2016, but he only just arrived here 2.5 months ago. We know many people who have been waiting for a lot longer, mm-hmm. and will continue.
Well, and Leah, jump in here. Is part of the complexity because he was coming from Cuba? Does that make it more difficult because of our sort of chilly relationship with that country?
That could have something to do with it. I think that there is a certain amount of bias against people from certain countries, and they do require more evidence. That's not a stated policy, but it's just something I've noticed. And then it does, the procedures do vary a little bit from one embassy to the other and the types of documents that they require at the embassy. But it sounds like, from what Vered said, that the problem and the real delay was with USCIS, which is the agency that handles everyone's petition, no matter what country you're ultimately going to be applying from.
Mm-hmm. Well, Indra, let's get you in here and then we'll go to the phones. You and I were talking just briefly before we went to air about the fact that you came to the United States as a child. And talk a little bit about what you remember, if you do, of that process and how it differed from when your father came to America.
Yes, well, actually, my father was an orphan in Mexico City at the age of 9. And then he slowly went from there to Monterrey. And from Monterrey, the border is pretty close. It's like a 3-hour drive. And so he started coming to the U.S. as a teenager. And so this... it was very easy for him. You know, he came into the U.S. There wasn't any kind of problem. It was a much more open border. People could come and go, obviously with some process, but not like it is today. Eventually, he found a job. He learned English, and he made a life in San Antonio. So this would have been in the late 40s for him. He was an older person compared to where, you know, when I came into the world. He went back home. He would go home every year. He met my aunt. They got married in the late 70s. They adopted me and I was brought over. And so a lot of that was really transparent for me. I really didn't see a lot of issues. But then again, it was a different time. He had U.S. citizenship. And so that opened up the door for his wife, my aunt, and then for me when he adopted me. So my entry was very... non-eventful. But we grew up, or I grew up, in an immigrant neighborhood in San Antonio, and we had a restaurant. And so the people that were our clientele were people who worked construction, you know, so we opened at, 5:30 in the morning, and we closed at 3 p.m. And so that was a whole different world of people's varied experiences. And so from what I remember from my own process, it wasn't... he had friends who were lawyers, because my father had a lot of friends. And so they facilitated the process for him. So we were really, really lucky in that way, lucky in ways that many people were not.
So there wasn't a decades long wait, mm-hmm. clearly.
Right. Yeah. We went in when I got a little older and got my Social Security card, went into school. So it was pretty seamless at that time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, let's go to the phones for a moment, and you can join our conversation if you have a question about immigration, if you have a story to share about your own process for getting to the United States and Alaska. The number statewide is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Christopher is on the phone from Anchorage. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I don't really have a question, more or less a comment. I'm married to a Filipino who's a U.S. citizen. We've been married for 12 years. She was brought over after being petitioned by her older sister, and then her older sister brought her parents and single siblings. Her father at that time, which is now approaching 20 years, petitioned her older brother. But because he was married and had a child, he was put on a much lower category. We've been checking and checking. You know, every year we check, and it barely moves. And now her father, who is in very poor health, will most likely pass away before his adult son will ever have a chance to come to the country. And it's very, very frustrating for us who did this legally, who now, we send money over to to support that family in the Philippines. We're putting now his kids through high school and now through college. That's how long it's been. And it's very frustrating for us to see this type of lengthy delays, and yet other people from other countries, some of those countries better off than the Philippines, which is a third world country, able to come over here and stay with, you know, not the problems we've had to go through. And that's just my comment. And I heard your previous guest mentioning the Philippines, and it's certainly exactly true. That's what we've been through.
All right. Well, thank you for calling, Christopher. And Leah, respond to this. It just seems amazing that it would take such a long time. As he said, you know, they put kids through high school and now college. What's going on there?
Well, there is a cap per country. So there's a 7% cap within this visa bulletin system. So the countries where that cap comes into play most often is the Philippines, Mexico, India, and China. And so people from those countries often have to wait longer than people from the rest of the world. And it's not uncommon, what the caller mentioned, is not uncommon where a petitioner, the U.S. citizen father in his case, passes away while waiting for that priority date to become current, that time when they can actually apply for a green card. And there is a situation where you can apply for something called humanitarian reinstatement, but it's very complicated, and it does feel very unfair to the people who are going through this process.
So talk a little bit about that cap itself. Is it a yearly number? And once people are on that list, don't they keep going up the list, or can they get bumped back? Because does it get reprioritized? How does that work?
So the cap, yeah, it is per fiscal year, and there's different numbers. I won't go into the exact details because it's a little too complicated, but there's different numbers per category. So the different categories themselves are unmarried sons and daughters of U.S. citizens, spouses and children of permanent residents, and then unmarried sons and daughters of permanent residents, married sons and daughters of U.S. citizens, and siblings. So there's four different categories. And within each of those categories, there's different wait times depending. And the wait time depends on how many petitions USCIS receives. And so if they receive a lot of petitions in a particular category, it's going to take longer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the more people who...
Decades longer?
Yes, in some cases. And especially when you've got, you know, certain countries where there's a lot of people wanting to immigrate to the United States, then they limit it at 7%. So that any one country isn't getting more than 7% of the total number.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we are talking about how to legally immigrate to the country. And we've got guests in the studio, an immigration attorney, and also a couple folks who have their own stories about this process. And Farid, I wanted to get back to you for a moment and ask about other family members. Didn't you tell me that you have a brother who also has a foreign-born spouse and the process was completely different?
Yeah, our family is very, very diverse. My mother immigrated to the United States from Israel. My stepbrother has married a woman from China and is in the process of going through the immigration process to bring her here. For them, I don't know too much about the details of their case, but I know that for them it will be easier because she has the ability to come here to visit. While they're waiting for all their paperwork, she can come and spend time here, even though she has to go back to China and she can't work while she's here. She can at least spend time here in this country. That was not the case for me and my husband, where he was simply unable to travel to the United States at all during our immigration process, which meant I was doing the traveling to Havana during that time. But there's no easy, people really have this misconception that it's like the movies where you travel, you know, on a beach vacation, meet somebody, and then decide that you're just going to go hop on down to the local church, get married, and 2 weeks later, poof, they're here. But that's absolutely not the case. Not the case. Nearly for anyone, almost regardless of what country. And
And it's quite expensive, isn't that correct?
It's a very expensive process. Every government organization that you have to touch has a fee associated with it. And then within the country, outside the United States, within that country, every step of the process has a fee associated with that. So whether it's for a medical exam, which is very expensive, or whether it's for an attorney to help you navigate this crazy process, or whether in our case we had to then get a secondary visa for my husband to travel to a third party country to have that, then there's embassy fees that go with that, plus the travel, the visa requirements for that third party country that have to be met. So it can be a process expensive enough to put you in debt for some time. Mm-hmm. There's no easy way around it.
And your husband's here now. How does he feel about, after all that process, does he feel safe and like, okay, whew, it's over and I'm okay now? Or is there still some anxiety?
Well, I think, you know, coming from such an extremely different environment, you know, literally coming from the tropics to near close to the Arctic, in and of itself is a big shock. But there are still, you know, I don't know that fear is a part of the question. I mean, you know, he's here, and that's the most important thing, is that we're finally living under the same roof in the same country. But I think there is, at least on my part, a lot of mistrust and a lot of misgivings about what the process really involves. And I think it's really difficult to have the transition once you are here. You know, for spousal visa, it's a little bit different. If you come under asylum, there's, I think, more resources available to people who come under asylum in terms of what they're able to get help with. But when you come under a spousal visa, it's really up to the immediate family to provide 100% of all that support and help with transition and navigating a new culture, new language, new way of doing things, new economy. So it's, you know, it's a very difficult, trying process, but we're just delighted that he's here. You know,
yeah,
that's,
yeah. You know, well, let's go back to the phones for just a moment. Kurt is also in Anchorage. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, Lori. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes. What's
so
your question?
I have a question and then a comment. My wife and I, we just returned from the consulate in Montreal, where she had her visa interview on Thursday. And thankfully, the visa was granted, I'm happy to say, after a nearly two-year process. And I have a question for the immigration attorney. And the question is, when does the clock start ticking toward the three-year requirement, permanent residency requirement for citizenship? The reason I ask is she has her visa will actually be a conditional permanent residency because we've been married for fewer than 2 years. I'm assuming that the clock starts ticking once she enters the United States under that conditional visa toward the three-year requirement before she's eligible for citizenship. I'm just wondering if that is the case.
Leah?
Yes, that is the case. So when she gets her permanent resident card, it'll say resident since a certain date, and that date is the date that she entered the United States on her immigrant visa. So for people like your wife who applied at a U.S. embassy abroad, that's going to be the date. For people who apply here in the United States, you know, because they had already entered the U.S. and applied for a green card here in the U.S., it would be the date that that application for permanent residence is approved, which, again, would be written on the permanent resident
card. So the conditional nature of the permanent resident card, because we've been married fewer than 2 years, that won't affect that timing then?
No, it won't. And in fact, what we're seeing now is the petition. So basically, just to give, it sounds like you're familiar with the process, but in case our listeners are not.
Right.
So if you've been married for less than 2 years at the time you get your permanent resident card based on marriage, then you are what's called a conditional permanent resident. And then before that two-year card expires, in the 90 days before it expires, you have to submit even more documents proving that you continue to be married to your spouse and you live with them. And then you'll get, once that petition to remove the conditions is approved, you get a 10-year permanent resident card. So, and what we're seeing now is those petitions to remove conditions on residents are taking over a year to process. So often what happens is people actually become eligible for naturalization while they're that other petition is still pending. And a lot of people wonder, well, what do I do now? You know, can I apply or not? And you can actually apply for naturalization while it's pending. And it's actually a good idea to do so as long as you're eligible, because it can actually get things moving on both applications.
Okay, so it can take up to a year just to have the condition removed?
Often it takes more than a year, yes.
All right, well, thanks, Kurt. I hope that helped you figure out some of this. The process is, as I was reading through some of the links that you sent me, which, by the way, if you're wanting to check out some information, there are links at our website with this Talk of Alaska post, alaskapublic.org. Go there and look for Talk of Alaska. And there are some links there that can explain some of the process. But wow, it is really complicated. And you know, I grew up speaking English, of course. So it's even for me to try to decipher all of that process was very daunting. And I can't imagine what it's like for someone who English isn't their first language. So it is a really a dense bureaucratic process, and I want to talk more about that. But Indra, I wanted to ask you about other people that you know, relatives or friends, and how the process has been for them as they try to come into the country now. Because we know that immigration changes. It's sort of the sentiments ebb and flow, and that has policy implications. And so what do you hear now from people who are trying to get here?
Oh, absolutely. It's changed quite a bit. And there is an element, I think, of fear of the unknown, of not speaking the language, of maybe saying something that could be perceived in a negative way. There's a bilingual newspaper in town, you know, Sol de Medianoche. And one of the reasons that we created the newspaper was to disseminate it and educate folks on a lot of things within the community, but definitely on immigration. And so it's a topic that, you know, we address almost every issue, because it's not just about the people that we know immediately and the people that we've known as we've grown up, but things are changing so fast. And we really don't know a lot of when the process changes. There may be a public register somewhere and a notice where it lets people know, but unless you're on top of it or you're Leah, you know, you're not going to be that well informed. And so what we've seen is people really have a lot of questions and people have a lot of fear. You know, in terms of the process, the money is an issue. It's a lot of money. You know, even if you're here and you're a permanent resident, and you can take the next steps, it's still a $700-$800 application fee, right? It's not going to be easy. It's going to be a little lengthy, depending on your circumstances. So, I mean, I think that, you know, what we see is people who are really have legitimate reasons to be here, you know, came in legally, have legal standing, but not necessarily the ability to navigate and the confidence to navigate the system and feel wholeheartedly that the system will be there for them, mm-hmm. you know. So that's what we've been seeing, you know. And so on occasion we have community meetings just giving information, or the Mexican consulate comes into town, and you see folks sort of emerge with a lot of questions.
And the consulate, the permanent consulate, closed down, and so now it's just like this pop-up consulate,
right,
that comes.
It's a consulate on wheels.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like a food cart. Yeah. just kidding. And it's not here long enough to really give people the full support that they need.
We are talking about legal immigration today on Talk of Alaska. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue with questions and calls as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
Thank you. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing legal immigration today. And Leah McDermid McKenna is an immigration attorney in the studio with us. I have a question for you. I also wanted to make sure that folks know that Farid Merez is in the studio with us, a business owner in Anchorage, and her husband is a recent immigrant from Cuba. And Indra Arriaga is an artist based here in Anchorage, and she immigrated from Mexico as a child. You can join us if you'd like. If you have questions or comments or your own story to share, 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide, 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, it's 550-8422, 550-8422. Before we go back to the phones, Leah, why did the consulate close here? I was surprised by that. What do you know why?
I don't actually know why. I assume it was a funding issue and that they weren't busy enough, although I used to work with the consulate and they seemed plenty busy to me. And I know there's a huge demand. And every time they do come up, they don't give people a lot of notice. And so there's always kind of a scramble to let people know they're coming. If you need to renew your passport or you need to get a copy of a birth certificate, you know, they have to scramble to get an appointment and get in there.
Yeah, I was surprised by that because it seemed like it was going in the you would expect them to be here more instead of less. And so I was surprised. Mm-hmm. And it probably is a funding issue, as you said. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Brenda is in Deering. Hi, Brenda.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment. Well, several, actually. This country is almost based on immigrants. And I've heard it said that you can go to Japan and not become a Japanese or go to China and not be called a Chinese. But you can come to America and become an American. And I was just wondering why that should be, I mean, to one person to decide who can come in and who can't. And that just baffles me. Thanks. I'll take your answer or your comments on the radio. Thank you. Bye.
All right. Thanks for the call, Brenda. It is interesting. It was actually leads into a question, Leah, that I had for you about why is it so different from country to country? Why is there not like a standardized immigration process that applies? I can understand why if there's a heavy demand from one country, and less demand from another country to try to immigrate, that there might be a prioritizing of how many visas come from each country. But why is the process different from country to country?
Well, I should clarify, it's not exactly different for people coming. I assume you're talking about immigrating to the United States.
Yes.
And the process is the same. The forms are the same. But once you get to the stage of applying at the U.S. Embassy abroad, each U.S. Embassy abroad has slightly different procedures about what type of documents they want you to bring. Some of them require you to send the documents ahead of time. Others want you to bring it to the appointment. Sometimes they'll send the medical exams from the embassy doctors directly to the embassy, and other times you need to bring it with you. So there's very specific instructions that you have to be up on for each individual country, and that posts requirements. So in theory, it should be the same around the world, although definitely when you talk about non-immigrant visas, which are like student visas, tourist visas, H-1B specialty worker visas, those are different. So and the difference there, especially with tourist visas, is if you are from a developing country where the average income is very low, it's going to be pretty difficult to get a tourist visa because they want the Department of State, the U.S. Department of State wants you to prove that you have strong ties to your country such that you're not going to want to remain permanently in the United States. And what that often means is that you have a lot of money. You have a lot of money in the bank. You have a good job. You own a home or property. And so there you do see a lot of differences from one country to another, whereas you know, there's something called the visa waiver program where most European countries are able to enter the United States without even getting a tourist visa. They can come for 90 days. So there's those kind of differences as well.
So the process is somewhat the same, but I one of the things I think that Brenda was getting at is that when people come here and they get legal status, they are excuse me, they are considered an American. But does it work the same way if you go to another country and become a legal citizen there? Are you still considered a person of your country of origin? And just, is there a different standard that applies in other places that differs from American citizenship?
Well, there's certainly different immigration systems throughout the world about who they allow in and what the criteria are. So, you know, Canada has a point-based system, which is different from ours. And there has been some proposals that we adopt a system like that one, which, you know, I won't get into. But there's definitely some negative considerations there. But I think, well, some people would say that you're not American until you naturalize, until you apply and become a U.S. citizen. And other people would say anyone who's living in the United States can call themselves an American because it's their home.
Mm-hmm. And the idea of dual citizenship, what countries allow that? Does America allow you to be a U.S. citizen and also hold citizenship in other countries?
Yes. The U.S. does allow dual citizenship, and most countries do as well, but there are some countries that do not. So Germany requires, for example, that you apply, you go through this application process in Germany to explain why you need to have dual citizenship. But most countries do. You do need to, when you swear, when you take the oath to become a U.S. citizen, you do have to swear your allegiance to the United States, and that if the law requires it, that you will bear arms on behalf of the United States and perform work of national importance for the United States. So there is a requirement that you show your primary allegiance to the United States, but dual citizenship is allowed.
But you can have essentially two passports.
Yes.
Interesting. Let's go back to the phones. Excuse me for a moment. Kristen is in Anchor Point. Hi, Kristen.
Hi. Thank you for letting me be on. My question has to do with something I heard on the world news yesterday. They were talking to people who hire seasonal workers into our country. They come in under a special visa, and they were talking about how it's difficult to get the workers this year because immigration and Homeland Security is not letting the people in. Then they said the most amazing thing. They said that Congress had actually raised the number of these visas that are available to allow it more people to come in and do this seasonal work, but that Homeland Security and Immigration were not issuing them. They're not only not issuing the old quota, they're not issuing the new quota. And it's interesting because Congress is the one that's supposed to be in charge of this, and yet these agencies are ignoring what Congress is directing. I'm kind of wondering who's supposed to be in charge now of all this.
Well, thanks for the call and the question, Kristen. Leah, you probably didn't hear the program that she was referencing yesterday, but do you have any insight into what may be going on there?
Well, because the Department of Homeland Security is part of the executive branch, they do promulgate their own regulations and executive, of course, the president can have executive orders. And so you do sometimes see these situations where it's at odds with what Congress has said should be happening. And it's just the way they've designated it. I agree. It shouldn't be happening to that extent. And when Congress speaks about what it believes our country needs in terms of immigration and seasonal workers, and especially here in Alaska, we certainly need seasonal workers to do all kinds of jobs in the hospitality industry and the fishing industry. And so
agriculture.
Right. And so it really does affect us here in Alaska greatly when the wishes of Congress and of our country and our state are not being followed by the Department of Homeland Security.
Indra, you were nodding as Kristen was talking. Did you want to add some comments here?
Yes, I think I heard part of the show that they're referring to. And, you know, one of the things that became very apparent and was addressed in the show that she referred to is the idea of sort of this conflict that we're having in our country, you know, between not only the different parts of government, but different parts of our philosophical makeup, you know, of what we need or people who can come and contribute, but yet we're afraid. And so one of the words that was brought up in that story that ran yesterday was the Browning of America, and the idea that even if you need people and you're letting them in, somehow that is going to impact you on another level, you know, which I totally disagree with. But I think that's what she's referring to, is like the left hand doesn't seem to know what the right hand is doing. On the one hand, we need, you know, we are a global community. We do have globalization, and, you know, we do have commerce that moves in and out, you know, through borders and the labor force as well. And so if we're sort of, on the one hand, restricting the source of labor that we need, we're going to suffer on the other hand. Mm-hmm. And so that it's a bigger topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, yeah. Let's thank you, Kristen, for the call. Let's stick with the phones for just a moment. Mike is in Anchorage. Hi, Mike.
Hello. I just had a K-1 visa denied last Wednesday. I'm still kind of choked up about it. And I was wondering, is there any possible appeal? It's like, this is America, and it was an arbitrary, flawed decision, because my understanding was that the embassy interview is supposed to determine if you have a real relationship or not. And if you do, if you went through all the hoops like we did for over a year, then you would get the visa. But instead, it was the guy asked some trick questions. My fiance was very deferential, you know, respectful, and he just said visa denied after, you know, just like a 5-10 minute interview. And I'm saying, wait a minute, we went through all the hoops. It was this a year long game of gotcha? You know, do everything we ask you to do, and then we're not even going to consider your data. We're just going to say forget you. You know, we're not giving you the visa. And we spent, you know, I don't know, a couple $1,000 and all that time going through all these crazy hoops. It was just, it was bizarre. It didn't seem like America. And now I'm wondering, is there any possible appeal?
Well, Mike, I can hear that this is a painful situation for you and obviously frustrating. I saw Vered nodding. And Leah, is there any recourse here?
It really depends on the situation and the reasons why it was denied. But in some cases, you can refile. In some cases, you can appeal. And in some cases, people do what Vera did, and they just go ahead and get married and then start over again filing a spousal petition. Mm.
So is that something that Mike could try, is that approach, or do you not know enough about the case?
I don't really know enough about it. But, yeah, it sounds like you might want to talk to an attorney, Mike, about that.
Yeah, let me also say, it's like there's no, we even went through a visa service that was very good at helping us do all the forms, but even they did not prepare for the interview. It's like they didn't say that this interview is going to be adversarial. They're going to try and trick you so that they can deny the interview or deny the visa. Like if they had said that, the chances are you're not going to get this, but you're going to go through all this time, all this effort, and all this anxiety. And then you know, it's just a game. We're not giving it to you anyway.
Vered, you've certainly been the most recently through this process of the three people here today. What can you say to Mike about what you experienced?
Well, hi, Mike. I was in exactly your shoes a little bit over a year ago, when my now husband, then fiance, and I applied for our K-1 visa. And our visa for the K-1 was also rejected on the grounds that my husband did not prove his intent to marry. And I'm not sure exactly what your case is, but what I do know is that for us, we simply moved our wedding to his country in Havana, Cuba, and we got married there. And then we started the process for the spousal visa. And even though it took a lot longer, you know, there are ways to continue the relationship and ways to continue going through the process, even if it is maddening and frustrating and it will add expense and time. You know, I think that you know, when you really care for somebody and you know that this is the person that you want to spend the rest of your life with, that you will basically do whatever is necessary. And I could not make heads or tails of why our case was rejected. We didn't actually even get to the interview. But I do know that it's not uncommon for those interviews to be adversarial, where they really are looking for reasons to deny visas, as opposed to granting visas on the basis of the evidence. It does feel like they're set up specifically to deny visas, even if that's not actually written. And I know it feels as if you're getting a knife through the heart and a gut punch, but I also believe that there is a way forward, and it takes time to regroup and kind of assess that and then replan. And, you know, you, on the one hand, you might have had the wedding planned here in the United States, and all those plans go up in smoke just like ours did. But then we planned and moved the wedding to Havana, and it was still a very special wedding, and we still had our friends and family there. And it was a lovely occasion, and it was in the tropics and warm instead of in the snow and the dark. And eventually the process finally did work, and it took a lot of work and a lot more money, but it did work. So I would just say wholeheartedly, I know what it's like to go through that, and, you know, it, keep one foot in front of the other, keep sight of the goal. And that is to be with your fiance and future wife, and to have your family together.
Well, good luck, Mike. And we need to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue on with more questions and calls about what the process is for legal immigration into the United States as Talk of Alaska continues.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
All right, we're back. That was fast. This is Talk of Alaska, and we are discussing legal immigration and what the process is. We just heard a heartfelt story of frustration from Mike in Anchorage about trying to help his fiance get here legally. We had a question by email about how the United States process compares to other countries. We talked a little bit about that, but Tom says in Fairbanks, wanted to know, is it generally easier for U.S. residents to get permanent status in other countries? If you want to move to Canada or other places, is it easier to go somewhere else than for people to come here? Or does that kind of change through ebb and flow through time?
I think it depends what country you're talking about. So like I mentioned, Canada has a point-based system. Mm-hmm. I believe you can even go on their website and just put in your qualifications and see how many points you come up with. Huh. I know they had a huge, I think their website may have actually crashed right after the presidential election because so many people were looking into that option. I'm not aware about other countries and their immigration policies, but I would assume they all have different requirements. And I think probably the countries that have less demand, probably some of the developing countries probably have less stringent requirements about what it takes to immigrate there.
Mm-hmm. And talk a little bit about diversity visas and what that means, and how are they decided from country to country?
So the diversity visa lottery is something that happens every fall between October and early December. And basically anyone who's a high school graduate and meets other certain requirements can apply from anywhere in the world. There are limits on the number of diversity visas that are issued to each area of the world, with each region or continent. And so with the highest number are issued to Africa, and the lowest number is actually, I believe, North America. And so they run the numbers, and if you're selected, then you can apply. And usually it's for people who are living abroad, and they'll be able to enter as permanent residents if they're selected.
Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Oh, All right, I guess we're not going back to the phones for a moment. If you would like to join us, there's still time. 1-800-478-8255. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. If you're in Anchorage, it's 550-8422. 550-8422. And you can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Leah, what are the clients that you work with? What do they mainly come to you for? What problems are most common, if there is such a thing? And what are you working with when you're getting calls from clients? What do they need?
Well, I see the whole gamut. So, I mean, I help a lot of people with spousal-based petitions. So a U.S. citizen coming to me who wants to sponsor either a fiancé or a spouse to come to the United States. I speak Spanish fluently, so I have a lot of clients from Mexico and Central America. And one issue that I do a lot of work on is people who have entered the United States. So a U.S. citizen comes to me, their spouse entered the United States without any papers. And maybe they have U.S. citizen children together. A lot of times they've been married for many years. And, you know, it seems like it should be pretty straightforward. You're married to a U.S. citizen, you have U.S. citizen children, but it's actually not if you entered without a visa. So in that situation, you have to apply for a waiver and show that your spouse would suffer extreme hardship if you are denied. And basically, the reason why that is you have to be in the U.S. legally or you have to have entered the U.S. legally, I should say, to be able to apply for a permanent residence here in the United States. Otherwise, you have to go back to the U.S. embassy in your home country to apply. But when you do that, you trigger this 10-year bar. And so the only way around that 10-year bar is if you get this waiver approved. And so for a lot of people, there's a lot of fear involved because they don't want to risk it. You know, they don't want to risk going to that interview and being stuck outside the country for 10 years. So it creates a very strange incentive where it actually creates an incentive where people just choose to remain undocumented in the United States, even though they are married to a U.S. citizen and they might have U.S. citizen children. But it's a complicated process. It's pretty hard to navigate that waiver process without an attorney. And so a lot of people just, you know, they can't afford it or they just don't want to risk it. And so they choose not to.
Do you hear, Indra, stories of people with those very fears?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, whether they're DACA recipients, you know, especially they're in the toughest position of all because, you know, they were given an option years ago that seems to have gone away. And now they're exposed and they're in these situations where they have roots here. They've always been here, some of them, and they're married. They have children. They have jobs. And for a slight window, they had agency. And now that seems to be slipping. And so we are seeing that a lot. And, you know, in Alaska, the Pew Research Center estimated perhaps, you know, around 400 people, you know, or DACA or in the DACA boat, but only about half of them applied for it. And so you have this this choice that they made, you know, similar to what Leah just said, where it's like, you know, you're taking a risk if you actually start any kind of process. Mm.
Vered, knowing you've been through this whole process, knowing what you know now, what would you recommend to people about how to do it the same or differently than you did?
Well, you know, for us, you know, it was a little bit different because in 2015, Cubans, specifically under the Cuban Adjustment Act, could actually come to the United States at any port of entry and fairly easily be granted entry. But that changed when Obama changed the regulation and opened the relationship up with Cuba. And so right at the time that we were considering our fiancé visa, that opportunity evaporated. And so we had a long conversation about how to navigate this and decided that it was more important to spend the money and the time and the energy to do things 100% legally than it was to try to circumnavigate the system, no matter how crazy it was. And so, you know, had I to do it over again, I would probably still do it the same way because the protection of having that legal status here and knowing that we are secure and knowing that we have we don't have to hide and we don't have to fear the next thing means that we get to sleep at night. Mm-hmm. It means that my husband can work. It means that we can visit family and travel openly and not have that fear where, you know, if you come undocumented, whatever the reason, and no matter how great the reason, it means that there's an element of fear that just can't go away. Even if you try to come out and become legal,
you have the risk of being deported.
You have a huge risk of being deported. And if you have family and children, the risks are so great that maybe you choose not to. And so you just live and make room for that fear.
Let's take one more quick question. Lauren is in Anchorage. Hi, Lauren.
Hi. I was just wondering. I'm aware that Samoans are the only U.S. nationals. And why is it they aren't considered citizens like Puerto Ricans? So why do they still have to become a citizen?
Let's see if Leah has any insight into that. Leah?
Yeah, so American Samoans do have to apply for naturalization. They don't have to go through the same step of first applying for permanent residence and then waiting the 3 or 5 years to apply for naturalization. But they do, because they are U.S. nationals and not born in the United States, you know, within the 50 states or Puerto Rico, it is the rules are different. So
it's a very complicated, daunting system. And I wanted to ask a question about what happens when people overstay their visa. And I imagine that you work with a lot of folks in that regard. Unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap up. Thanks so much to my guests, Leah McDermott McKenna, an immigration attorney here in Anchorage, Vered Merez, whose husband just recently came to Alaska from Cuba. Vered is a small business owner in Anchorage, and Indra Arriaga is an artist and was born in Mexico and now lives in Anchorage. Thanks so much to all three of you for being here, and thanks for listening, all of you out there in Alaska. Thanks to Dave Waldron, our engineer, and Wesley Early on phones. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. This program is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. This is Alaska Public Media.